This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
It's the March episode. Welcome, listeners. I'm Ian Todd, the magazine's staff writer, and I'm joined in the studio today by news editor Elizabeth Pearson.
Hello.
And the magazine's editor Chris Bramley.
Hello.
Coming up later in this episode, we'll be talking to Antronik Sefilian from the University of Cambridge about why his latest research throws doubt on the existence of Planet Nine in the outer reaches of the solar system. But now we're going to be taking a look at what we found out while putting together the March edition of the magazine. And Chris, you've been making everyone else in the office pretty jealous over the past few weeks as a result of a trip to Swedish Lapland.
Well, yes, I went to Swedish Lapland in last month in January, middle of January, to go and have a look for the aurora. And the good news is that they were there; they appeared, and it was a fantastic experience.
Wasn't this like a designated, like a planned package trip? It wasn't just you kind of going.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's right. So it was with a group called Lights Over Lapland, who run organised and guided photo tours and aurora observing tours in Lapland, so Swedish Lapland, Norway, and Finland as well. And yeah, it turned out really well. I actually got photo evidence as well of the aurora, so it was really good, which you'll see in the March issue. And it was quite sudden when they appeared, actually, because we'd just got to this spot that the guide knew. We were just setting up our cameras on our tripods, and all of a sudden there they were. So although we had been given lots of guidance beforehand about the settings and how to focus and everything like that, it all happened so suddenly that and I had like two layers of gloves on because it was so cold. Get the gloves off, focus, get the right ISO, get this, set the right exposure. I wasn't quite, it was like the first time, the first picture that we took was of the aurora, so they're a little bit blurry, unfortunately, when I was reviewing them.
Yeah, I went out several years ago now to Iceland to go and see the aurora for the first time, and I've been aurora hunting twice. On both times, we didn't see it until the last night I was there.
Yes, yeah. That's right. That's so I was
so I was always happy about that. And I remember when I was in Iceland, the bus was going to the place where we were going to go and see them, and we were looking out the window, and you could see it amazingly outside of the window. And then as soon as we got to the place where you could actually take out and get the photos, they kind of went away.
Yes,
but in some ways that was quite nice because you could just look out of the window of the bus and sort of take it in. Sort of just witness it without worrying about filling about with your camera.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's it.
How does it actually appear to, like the naked eye as you're standing there? Because everyone will be familiar with the ridiculous, images of, green and pink streaking across the sky. Does it actually look like that?
So the one that I saw in Iceland, it looked like a sort of cloud that was sort of arcing across the sky. Basically, it looked like a cloudy rainbow. And then it got narrower and narrower and narrower. And then when it sort of just became this one thin band across the sky, that was when it became bright green.
Okay.
It changes. It changes. Because it, if it's quite faint, because the display I saw started off quite faint, and your eye can't pick up colour.
Yeah.
With objects that faint, so it appeared like white, like a kind of misty cloud.
Whoa. And
then the reason it was identifiable as an aurora because its form was so obviously uncloud-like. It started off as a ray, kind of going diagonally up into the sky, you know, to higher altitude.
Yeah.
And then it kind of curved and bent and turned into a wavy form, and then another bit appeared to the right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that kind of change that happens over a 10 seconds, 20 seconds, that kind of thing that makes it obvious that's what you're looking at. And as it gets more bright, you start to see the colour as well.
For me, the thing that was really quite shocking was how slowly it moves. Because you see all of these videos online and they're
time lapses,
yeah, that's the word. Yeah. And so they happen much faster on the actual, like, you can tell that it's moving and you can see it moving, but it's very slow, it's very gradual.
Yeah, that's right.
But if you lived in that region, could you theoretically see it every night, or is it seasonal, or?
It's
supposedly dependent on the weather, isn't it, as well? If it's cloudy.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
It happens more frequently around October and March, those times of year.
Yeah.
But it's technically, you can see it any time of year. It's just that generally if you're in an Arctic region where it's likely to be, that means you're going to have very bright summer days.
Yeah.
And you can't see this faint coloured light on the sky if it's a bright sunny night.
It's true, it just happened, isn't it, that far north.
Yeah. But one of the things I really liked about the feature you wrote about it, Chris, was all the other stuff that you got to do. Like, you got to stay in a hotel made of ice.
Yes, the ice hotel was absolutely incredible.
I mean, it sounds ridiculously uncomfortable.
Well, actually, no, it was very... I mean, it was cold. It was a constant -5 in there. In the ice hotel, you get changed in this kind of warm room.
Okay.
And you have a little kind of changing room in that part of the hotel. And then, so you get all ready, get into your kind of base layer, get your boots on, walk over to the hotel, and then get into your sleeping bag, sleep for the night, and then they wake you up at 10 o'clock in the morning with some hot juice and say, right, come on out, it's time to leave now. And you have to leave because all the rooms have ice sculptures in, and it's like an art gallery during the day, so guests can walk around the different rooms and look at the amazing artworks.
So what do you do with your passport and traveler's checks?
Well, that's why you have every guest in every room has a room in the warm area as well
they can use
as a locker or storage or something like that. So it's quite a unique kind of, it's a kind of unique logistical element to the ice hotel.
I think it's one of those places you only stay a night to say that you've done it. It's not somewhere like your base of operations whilst you're exploring
land. And there are kind of, you can stay in warm rooms in the hotel as well.
Right,
it's
okay.
Not just like you can only stay in the ice hotel. So you can have like one night in the sleeping on in the nice bed, a normal bed for the other nights or whatever.
But you're also going on. What do you call it? Like when you're pulled by dogs on
dog
sled.
Sledding, I mean, and that's class. Snowmobiling and cross country skiing. It was a lot. You think it was -20 there. It was very cold at that time.
It sounds knackering.
You know, it was a lot. There was so much you could do out there, and it's actually with the right clothing, which all where we stayed, they all have very big rooms, you know, with loads of snowsuits and all the right kit.
Yeah.
Heavy snowshoes, you know, mittens and everything, balaclavas, hats, everything. So you actually dress right, and you don't actually notice the cold that much. Mm-hmm. And it's actually quite thrilling to be out in an environment like that if you've not really experienced it before.
Awesome.
And a lot of the time, I kind of, you know, it almost felt like I was something like an astronaut, you know, being out on this kind of on this frozen ice with nothing around, you know, in a kind of thick space, in a thick kind of snowsuit.
Yeah,
it was very similar to how being an astronaut looked.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
That actually brings us on quite nicely to another feature in this in the March issue, because Ezzy's been looking at the Apollo 9 mission, which I've been reading, because I was kind of fascinated, because whenever I think of the big Apollo missions, I think, like most people, I probably think of Apollo 8, because they went around the moon for the first time, and Apollo 11 for obvious reasons, because that's when they landed on the moon. But Apollo 9 really was the first time that they'd actually tested out what they were going to do. I mean, the entire mission happened in Earth orbit, so they didn't really go near the moon, but it was like all the docking procedures and...
It was the first time that they did an on-orbit test of the lunar module. And it was the first time that the lunar module flew away from the spacecraft, which is also the first time that anybody's been in... And one of the only times, in fact, that people have been in space without a way of... in something that couldn't get back on Earth.
Yeah.
If the lunar module attempted re-entry, it would not survive.
Yeah.
And so they drifted like about 150 kilometers away from their nearest way home, which to me sounds really intimidating.
And then had to use thrusters to...
Yes,
to get back.
They were testing the ascent and descent thrusters.
Yeah.
So the ones that would take the Apollo 11 onwards to the surface of the moon and then get them back off of it again.
Yeah, because I think it's worth pointing out that maybe people aren't kind of au fait with the different aspects of the Apollo missions. Once they'd actually launched on the Saturn V, there were then like three different modules. So there was like the command module, which is where the astronauts lived and slept and ate and worked. But then they would have to then dock with the lunar module.
Yes.
And then stay there for a day or two. Yes. And then the lunar module would separate and carry two astronauts down to the moon while the command module pilot...
just went in orbit around.
Went in orbit around the Earth.
Yeah.
And Apollo 11, that was Michael Collins.
Yes.
Yeah. So it was basically testing all that stuff out, wasn't it?
Mm.
It was testing a lot of procedures. And in fact, the commander, James McDivitt, who was one of the two astronauts who went in the lunar module, ended up as the sort of overmanager of the Apollo program. And he was the overmanager during Apollo 13. So he said apparently that was really useful, because in Apollo 13, they had to use the lunar module as a lifeboat. And so he'd done half of the... he himself had trialed a bunch of the emergency procedures that Apollo 13 needed to use, and he could sort of talk them through it, and he found that really useful.
Mm. That's really useful, isn't it? Because these kind of less glamorous missions, they might look a little bit, you know, less boring, but actually they're... events like Apollo 13 show that it's essential to do those kind of mock-ups because you never know what's going to happen, do you?
It's exactly. One of the reasons why I've really liked writing and looking up these features is because you get to learn about the Apollo missions that nobody ever talks about. So Apollo 7 and Apollo 9 and Apollo 10 and these ones that they were hugely important and they did really impressive things, and there's some really interesting stories as well. Associated with them all, but no one tends to hear them anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it was a 10-day mission, launched on the 3rd of March, landed on the 13th of March, 1969, and then obviously just months later, they landed on the moon. So it was, you know, the time scale wasn't...
It was in, you know, because they had Kennedy's challenge of we must land on the moon in 69. And so they'd planned five missions that year in the hope that one of them would eventually get to the moon. And when you look at that back now, it seems ridiculous.
The pace. And no one had ever done any of this before, had they?
Yeah.
I mean, it's absolutely at the cutting edge of what was technologically achievable. And they were just racing through it, weren't they?
Especially if you look at sort of like the Russian missions, because they did have their own lunar program. They pretended they didn't for many years, but the Soviets did have a crewed lunar program. And they were saying that every step needed to be tested two or three times before they would take the next one and risk, yeah, risk human lives. Whereas with Apollo, it was like, yep, did that once, it worked, next step.
Yeah,
yep, that worked, did it once, next step.
I know, because that was the thing. It seemed to be quite a lot of the quite a lot of the Apollo era, and I suppose even before, with the kind of since the launch of Sputnik, it was like the Soviets had outdone the US at each, yeah, stage. And even with this, it was 2 months before Apollo 9, the Soviets had already done that. They'd already done manned docking with their Soyuz 4, I think it was.
Yeah, Soyuz 4, yeah, and 5, I think,
yes,
it was.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So it was like they were constantly playing catch up, but then the US ultimately beat them to the surface of the moon in the end. Mm-hmm. But one of the other interesting things about Apollo 9 was poor old Rusty Schweikart, who's my favourite named Apollo.
Oh, yeah. I just
love saying his name.
Rusty Schweikart.
Yeah. He was the space sec as well, wasn't he? He was supposed to do a spacewalk. It was supposed to be 2 hours, but they had to reduce it down to,
yes,
45 minutes or something.
But he was unwell in space, to put, yeah, it diplomatically.
Yes.
And if you're doing a spacewalk, you're in a spacesuit, you can't get to your face to clear anything away. And so it's actually quite dangerous. There's been a couple of incidents in the past couple of years where people...
Yes, Luca Parmitano, the Italian?
Yeah,
his
spacesuit started filling, yeah, with water.
Yeah.
And another, Chris Hadfield, he, yeah, had, I think it was a CO2 leak or something,
right,
which basically meant his eyes turned acidic.
Oh,
and
gosh,
he couldn't,
oh,
see,
goodness,
and things like that. So they, yeah, it's when you sort of see these people in their spacesuits going around on the outside of the space station, it seems quite, you know, majestic and balletic. And then you actually find out what it's like, and you sort of hear about the, you know, the shoes taking their toenails off, and the lunar astronauts, moon dust is terribly chafing when it gets into your underwear.
it was
hard being an astronaut, and particularly hard being an Apollo astronaut, when you've not only got these incredibly physically demanding challenges, you've got the entire, you know, billions of US taxpayer dollars riding on you successfully completing a mission.
Yeah, and maybe not all the technology and research and experience that, you know, astronauts on the ISS currently enjoy.
Yeah.
But from Apollo 9 to Planet 9, Ez?
Yes. So we've heard some more news about a potential ninth planet. A lot of people have been thinking that there might be a ninth major planet, I should say, somewhere in our solar system for centuries, decades. People have been thinking that there is one. But
Beyond Neptune.
But the best evidence for it came a couple of years ago. In 2016, when some people were looking at some things happening out in the Kuiper Belt. Ever since, people have been searching to see whether or not there might be a ninth planet in our solar system. But a new study has recently come out which suggests that might not be the case. So I talked to Antronik Sefilian from the University of Cambridge about why his latest research says that there might not be a ninth planet in our solar system after all.
So in 2016, the proposal of the existence of a ninth planet was published in an article. And the reason for believing that there should be a ninth planet in the outskirts of the solar system is that we know of almost 30 objects in the trans-Neptunian space. The trans-Neptunian space is the region in the solar system beyond the orbit of Neptune. So it's in the distant parts of the solar system. And we know of almost 30 objects out there which are showing signs of gravitational anomalies. And this would be that specifically these objects are kind of showing that they are clustered in one direction instead of being randomly distributed around the solar system in a sense.
And your study suggests that there might not be a ninth planet within our solar system. So what do you think is going on instead?
But the problem, of course, when the Planet 9 proposal was published, we were intrigued by the idea, and we were also intrigued by the observations that this Planet 9 is supposed to be explaining, mainly the thing which I mentioned just now, the clustering of some trans-Neptunian objects. And this was very exciting for us, but back then it seemed for us more natural and perhaps less dramatic in a sense that instead of allowing for a Planet 9, why not allow for lots of small objects in the trans-Neptunian space and see what do these small objects collectively can do? And that's the way we thought about the problem. And it turned out that indeed this process works. So now what we're envisioning, instead of planet nine, we're envisioning a collection of objects, say thousands or maybe 10,000s of small objects, something like Pluto or even smaller than Pluto. And these are distributed beyond the space, beyond the orbit of Neptune in the transneptunian space. And you can think of it as a disk. So you can envision of this collection of orbits as disks, as a one disk, which is beyond the orbit of Neptune. And it turns out that we found in our study with my collaborator Jihad Touma at the American University of Beirut in Lebanon that these small objects, through their small but non-negligible gravitational effects, basically can do the same thing as Planet Nine does, and it can explain all the observational features that we're seeing in the outskirts of the solar system.
And how big would the Kuiper Belt need to be in order to create the effects that we've seen?
All right, it's not a matter of how, it's not a question of how big it should be, but we showed in our study that this disk that we're envisioning, which is formed of lots of small objects, should be radially extended. So the Kuiper Belt starts somewhere from beyond the orbit of Neptune. Neptune is situated at 30 astronomical units, where one astronomical unit is the distance from Earth to Sun. The Kuiper Belt extends from 30 to 50 astronomical units, and we do not know of much more objects beyond this distance of 50 AU. So in our study, what we're envisioning is that there should be other objects, and lots of them, beyond 50 astronomical units, and maybe up until 700, 800, 900 astronomical units.
And do you think that this theory is putting the final nail in the coffin of Planet Nine, or should we still keep looking?
If one reads our paper, in our paper we never say that there should be no Planet Nine. But what we are basically arguing for is that if there are lots of small objects out there, they have some small but non-negligible gravitational effects, right? These gravitational effects usually are just, let's say, they are not taken into account, right? Because usually the way of thinking about it is that they won't do much. But what we're trying to argue in our paper is that it could be even possible that there is another version of Planet Nine, perhaps closer to the Sun with less mass instead of the supposed 10 Earth mass Planet Nine, in combination with another version of our disk, maybe with much less number of objects in it. So it could even be possible that the combination of another version of Planet Nine with another version of our disk might be operating at this moment.
And so with sort of, if there was a Planet Nine, sort of proving that would be relatively easy. You just, they've been doing lots of surveys to try and find it, in fact. Is there any way that we could prove whether or not your theory is right, or do we just have to go on the theory?
All right. So yes, it is probably easier to detect Planet Nine than the objects which constitute our disk. That probably is true. One of the reasons for that is because the objects which constitute our disk, as we show in our study, they should be on kind of circular paths. So, and because they are very distant from the Sun, and they are not on elliptical paths, but on circular paths, they will not come close to the Sun enough so that we would see them. So in that sense, Planet Nine, detecting Planet Nine might be easier, yes. But we expect that with improved observational facilities, which will surely be deployed in the hunt for Planet Nine, will also improve statistics about small bodies roaming in the transneptunian space with their mass and kinematics included. And it could even be possible that these campaigns may improve indications for a massive extended disk, just like we argue in our paper, before they even find a super Earth planet. So the search should be continued.
So regardless of which theory proves to be correct in the long run, it's a good thing for science, and it's a good thing for getting to know our solar system a bit better.
Yes, of course, for the reason that I just mentioned, and because it could even be possible that there is a Planet Nine and there is another version of our disk. So it might be possible that astronomers will detect Planet Nine through their observations, but probably it could be possible that whenever they detect planet 9 and then they try to deduce the mass and the location and all the other kinematics of this supposed planet 9, and if it doesn't match with their predictions, it probably indicates that it's acting together with what we are envisioning with the Trans-Neptunian disk.
So it could be a mixture of the two together.
Exactly.
Yes. Well, if there's one thing that we've learned in the past, it's that the more you look at space, the more things you've turned up and the more interesting things you find. So hopefully the search will keep turning up new things.
Right.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today, Antronik.
All right. Thank you so much.
That was Antronik Sefilian, and you can find out more about the outer reaches of the solar system and the search for Planet 9 in the March issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine. There's lots to see in the night sky this month, which we cover in detail in our sky guide in this month's issue. But if you only have one chance to get out under the night sky in March, have a look for the beautiful Beehive Cluster. This is a glittering concentration of closely packed stars. Astronomers have found there are over 1,000 in total, which looks magical in a pair of binoculars. It's well placed in the early evening skies at the start of March when the moon's out of the way and the sky is nice and dark. The cluster's in the constellation of Cancer, midway between the twin bright stars of Gemini, Castor and Pollux, and the reverse question mark shape made by the stars of Leo. It'll be over the southeastern horizon, halfway up the sky to overhead by 7 p.m. as it starts to get nice and dark. There's more tips on finding the beautiful Beehive and other great night sky targets over the coming weeks in the March issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can discover more about the search for Planet 9, the heroic feats of the Apollo astronauts on going on an Arctic Aurora adventure in the March issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine. And don't forget our regular sections, which help you discover the wonders of the night sky this month and find the right equipment to observe it with. From all of us here at BBC Sky at Night magazine, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Fletcher. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or simply head to iTunes.